Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
The longest war in American history is coming to an end. It's been two decades since U.S. troops first set foot in Afghanistan, over which time thousands of American lives have been lost, trillions in American treasure spent. In this special edition of Hold the Line, we'll look back at the 20-year conflict and ask what was achieved, and also what does the future hold for the Afghan people.
After 20 years, $1 trillion spent training and equipping hundreds of thousands of Afghan national security and defense forces. 2,448 Americans killed, 20,722 more wounded, and untold thousands coming home with unseen trauma to their mental health. I will not send another generation of Americans to war in Afghanistan with no reasonable expectation of achieving a different outcome.
Welcome to this special edition of Hold the Line. I'm Buck Sexton. When it comes to matters of war like this one, we should all be thinking about what's best for our troops, best for America. It shouldn't be about partisanship. These are not the kind of topics, these are not the decisions that have to be made by the commander-in-chief and by those at the Pentagon that should be infused with politics. And we wanted to take a look today at both what happened in Afghanistan as much as we can, looking at what was gained, if anything, and also what it looks like going forward into the future. Let's remember that the Trump administration wanted to draw down troops entirely as well. So it would be unprincipled for me now to sit here and say that Trump supporters like myself have not wanted there to be a removal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. But that doesn't mean we can't discuss what will be left in place, what the Afghan forces are up against, and what the Taliban is doing to try to overthrow the government that we spent 20 years mentoring, training, equipping, funding. And it is rapidly falling apart. President Biden is already telling us that the future is certainly up to the Afghan people. Here's what he says.
The United States did what we went to do in Afghanistan: to get the terrorists to attack us on 9/11 and deliver justice to Osama bin Laden, and to degrade the terrorist threat to keep Afghanistan from becoming a base from which attacks could be continued against the United States. We achieved those objectives. That's why we went. We did not go to Afghanistan to nation build. And it's the right and the responsibility of the Afghan people alone to decide their future and how they want to run their country.
There seems to be something approaching a bipartisan consensus, or at least a bipartisan majority, that does want withdrawal from Afghanistan, which is currently underway. 95% of U.S. troops have already been removed from the country. There is some force presence there. And one thing we'll certainly discuss is what will be left either behind in Afghanistan or in the region to try to handle the original mission. And let's all remember that as to why we went into Afghanistan. It was in response to the attacks of 9/11 and because the Taliban had played host to Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda training camps under bin Laden's leadership and Zawahiri's leadership were operating freely and openly in Afghanistan. We went there on a counterterrorism mission that then expanded into a nation-building campaign. Now we're told that there will still be a counterterrorism mission in Afghanistan. Here's Secretary of Defense Austin.
You know, our major focus going forward is to make sure that, violence, terrorism cannot be exported from Afghanistan to our homeland. And so we'll maintain the capability to be able to not only observe that, but also address that if it does emerge.
They will still have in the region some forces to strike against terrorist threats to the U.S. and its allies around the world. That's the promise that's being made by the Secretary of Defense. What would that look like? How could we have resources? What would the force structure be in the region? How effective will they be? And then the giant question that looms over all of this, how long can the Afghan government hold out? Is it possible that they could actually maintain control of the country, the capital? They've already lost almost 50% of the territory that is technically within Afghan borders. Here is Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying it's not a foregone conclusion the Taliban will win.
The future of Afghanistan is squarely in the hands of the Afghan people. And there are a range of possible outcomes in Afghanistan. And I want to emphasize repeatedly, and I've said this before, a negative outcome, a Taliban automatic military takeover, is not a foregone conclusion.
We'll see. We've got experts here, a great lineup of guests to talk to you about all these different aspects of the situation in Afghanistan, past and present and future. Coming up, we'll speak to a decorated veteran of the war in Afghanistan about this U.S. withdrawal. Retired Army Ranger Sean Parnell joins us next. While many are celebrating the end of America's longest war, the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan is bittersweet, especially for veterans who fought there and have known what the sacrifices are on their side and on the Afghan national military side. Beginning in October of 2001 with Operation Enduring Freedom, an estimated 800,000 men and women of the United States military were deployed to Afghanistan at one time or another. According to the Department of Defense, over 2,300 died in the war with over 20,000 wounded. That doesn't include the unseen wounds many veterans face upon their return from PTSD and other symptoms and syndromes. Seems like a high price to pay for a nation that now appears to be on the verge of reverting back to Taliban control, the very enemy that the U.S. military was sent in part to defeat. Joining me now is decorated combat veteran and Republican candidate for the United States Senate in Pennsylvania, Sean Parnell. Sean, my friend, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Buck. Thanks for having me.
As a combat veteran of Afghanistan, as you see that U.S. troops are out, they're leaving the country, what do you think? What do you feel?
Well, it is bittersweet. As you said in your intro, you think about it like this. I just turned 40 a couple of days ago, and we've been in that country for, what, 20 years now? So half of my life, our nation's been deployed to Afghanistan. All of my adult life, the only profession that I've really known outside of a post-military life is a nation that's at war in Afghanistan. And, you know, we fought in that country for 485 days. As you know, 85% of my men were wounded, some twice. I think one guy was wounded three times. I was wounded myself. You know, we gave a lot in that country. You know, back then our mission was to find Osama bin Laden and take care of the Afghan people. Unfortunately, we didn't find Osama bin Laden, but we found thousands of enemy troops all along the Afghan-Pakistan border, and we killed 350, some of the worst terrorists the world has ever known in those mountains. And I think the world is a better place for it, and I think Afghanistan as a country is in a better place for it. But I just worry that all of our gains will be lost after a few months after the United States pulls out, and that's— it's hard, Buck. You know, I'm sitting here, you know, I haven't talked to anybody about this, but I find myself wondering what was it all for? I mean, we got Osama bin Laden, right? We taught a lot of young Afghan girls to read. And I do believe that we made that country a better place, built wells and schools and really helped the Afghan people build their country. But to date, I've probably lost 30 of my closest friends. And that's just a hard pill to swallow, man. You know, yes, we did good things for that country, but when it was all said and done, was it worth it? I think we did great things there, but the human cost was certainly high.
Sean, the Afghan side of this, and I mean not the Taliban side, obviously, but the allied Afghan side, military, political leadership, why couldn't they get it together? I mean, why after 20 years of the United States mentoring troops, providing security for Afghan politicians, the president of Afghanistan and others were able to rely on, you know, the United States being there to back them up. And it feels like it's all so fragile still. Why couldn't they get it? I don't know how else to say it other than why couldn't they get it together more on their side with the U.S. doing everything they could to let them be self-sustaining?
Yeah, you're so right. And I think one word, Buck, corruption. And corruption, what we would call corruption here in the United States, is sort of woven into the fabric of Afghan culture. And it's not seen as like a negative thing. Like, I don't want people watching your show from the West thinking like I'm calling the Afghan people corrupt. No, it's just their culture is so different from ours. They don't see the way that they conduct themselves in negotiations as corrupt. They have a different set of standards. And look, the Afghan National Army, the Afghan border police, the Afghan police, by and large, are courageous Afghans and patriots who love their country and want to protect it. But at the end of the day, if you can't pay them, if you can't get them water, if you can't get them food because the government that's supposed to be supporting you is siphoning the cash and those supplies away from you, you're not going to have an army for very long. And so a lot of it feels so fragile because at every single layer of leadership in that country, from the president down to ground level commanders, there's corruption. They take for themselves before they give to their people or their troops. And that's just always sort of the Afghan way. And I think part of that, Buck, is because the country for thousands of years is so tribal. You know, like we understand Afghanistan as lines drawn on a map and a country with clearly defined borders. But the people that live in Afghanistan, especially if you go to the border, right? Most people that live along the border of Afghanistan don't even know that they live in a country called Afghanistan. You know, the views of the world, you know, that they have are all tribal and seen through the prism of tribalism. And most Afghans don't even know how old they are. You know, there'll be tribes that are separated by a few miles in Afghanistan and have never seen one another. Afghanistan was always going to be an uphill climb in terms of nation building, just because of how fractured that country is and has been.
So I got to ask on the U.S. military leadership side of this. And I was in Afghanistan a decade ago, interfacing with the top brass, four-star general in theater. And it always felt like there was this, now we're going to do what was done before, right? The year before, the cycle of troops who were here before. We're going to do it better, though. And it felt like year in and year out, just based on me seeing from the CIA side of it, how the military was conducting itself here, there were the people like you who were fighting the battles and protecting the villages and building the wells. But at the very top, there were generals who kept coming up with, oh no, we're going to do it right this time. Was there careerism involved here and not wanting to level with the American people that this was effectively an impossible task to create a self-sustaining Afghanistan? I mean, I know there's a lot of different generals involved here, but generally speaking, pardon the expression, were the top people in the United States military strategically honest over the last decade, and really the last two decades, with what was possible there?
Now, look, I think that what you're talking to speaks with issues within the Army's promotion system and the meritocracy that we use as officers to promote people from within. And so what I mean by that is there's a real reluctance as a battlefield commander to get on the battlefield update brief with a commander that's higher than you and say, you know what? Things are out of control. We can't find the enemy. and we're struggling here, right? Because if you give a report like that, and you give a report like that on a regular basis, you're not going to get promoted. You're going to get poor marks. And the guy that's out there saying, sir, we've got this area on lockdown. We've killed 20 enemy troops. We've got no problems, right? And then you see that report echoed up the chain of command to where you get to the point where there are generals, like you're a general, you're overseeing the entire theater of Afghanistan. You're thinking to yourself, well, hey, nothing's wrong. And part of that problem is people are afraid to give honest feedback from the ground, because if you want to get promoted, you can't really give honest feedback. You can't really think outside the box. So what happens is that guys like me, not just me, but anyone who's seen ground combat in Afghanistan that is willing to give an honest assessment of what's going on there, they end up getting out because combat sucks. You know, it's just brutal. And if you're feeling like your words aren't being heard by the chain of command, right, you tend to get out. And what you're left with as officers progress up the chain are officers who are willing to play the game, right? And that's how you end up with a man like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, who seems, you know, most Republicans, I think, see this now, and indeed probably some Democrats and independents as well. General Milley is a politician, and
it feels like four stars. Feels like anybody with stars on their shoulder these days is having to play a lot of political games in the DOD sphere. But Sean, thank you, my friend. Good to see you, and thank you for your service.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Buck.
As U.S. troops complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Taliban continues to gain ground. When we come back, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Bill Roggio, joins us to take a look at the Afghan National Forces and their efforts to hold the line against the advancing enemy.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Two decades after being toppled by the U.S.-led coalition during Operation Enduring Freedom, the Taliban seems once again on the cusp of reestablishing dominance over much of Afghanistan. This map, recently published by the BBC, shows that the Taliban controls or is vying for control of roughly two-thirds of the entire country. That number is going to increase rapidly unless government forces can hold out against this onslaught. For insight into the Taliban's strategy here in the aftermath of U.S. withdrawal, I want to bring in senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Bill Roggio. Bill, good to see you again.
Thanks for having me, Buck. It's a pleasure.
So let's just start with the speed of the decline of government control here. Put this into context for us. How rapidly is the Taliban seizing territory, and how does this factor into what their timeline is?
Yeah, the Taliban, so what the Taliban did was they waited for the U.S. to announce its withdrawal and then begin withdrawing its forces. The Taliban did this because U.S. Air Forces, U.S. military aircraft, have been effective at killing their fighters and keeping them from taking the cities. And once the U.S. military was focused on withdrawal, it wouldn't have the excess forces to be able to strike at the Taliban. So that began on April 14th. By mid-May, the Taliban started taking a handful of districts. By the end of May and beginning of June, that's when the real onslaught began. So I've been the person that began recording this. And by when President Biden made his announcement, there were 73 districts under Taliban control out of 407. And then today, that number is 223. And most of that occurred from the beginning of June up until today. And most of this has taken place in northern Afghanistan and western Afghanistan. This is where many of the power brokers within the Afghan government and outside of the Afghan government as well, who are anti-Taliban, this is where they reside. This is where they derive their power from local fighters, from taxing, from running governments, things of that nature. And if the Taliban can deny that to the Afghan power brokers, this territory to the power brokers, the Afghan government is in a very, very difficult position.
So they've started their offensive. I mean, a lot of people would assume that in a insurgency situation like this, they would consolidate, the Taliban would consolidate those areas where they're already strong and then try to project force into the north, in particular the country where the Northern Alliance and famously where the U.S. was able to partner and establish essentially a foothold after 9/11 to get the roll-up of the Taliban going. So they're going right into the power base of what would be the pushback against the Taliban outside of Kabul, at least, and having success so far. Is that where we are?
That is correct, Buck. Yes. Yeah, so the south and the east, this is where the Taliban are strongest. They already have a solid lock on those areas. They could either expend their forces trying to take cities, which they are. They're fighting inside Kandahar City, inside of Lashkargah, the capital of Helmand Province, and Ghazni City, the capital of Ghazni. They're doing that, but they're not. They didn't devote all their forces in order to take what I would consider to be the low-hanging fruit in the south, particularly. They took it up to they went up into the north. A lot of these districts that the Taliban have taken control of, these were areas that were heavily contested to begin with. So what we've seen over time is that the number of Taliban-controlled districts increased, the contested districts have decreased, but also the number of districts that were outright controlled by the government have decreased, about 20 or so of those districts. So that means the Taliban didn't even have a presence in about 20 districts in Afghanistan. They rolled up and they forced the government either to surrender or to flee. So yeah, I think this is a very crafty strategy. And I'd like to point out one other thing, Buck. This strategy, it was executed, it was planned, organized, and executed by the Taliban under the nose of NATO, U.S., and Afghan intelligence. And they've been planning and organizing this offensive for years. It's no accident that once the U.S. withdrawal was announced, the Taliban went on the offensive. They're going for it. Now, I think we're seeing a slowdown of this right now. I think they are consolidating a lot of those areas they control. The government's taking back a handful of districts here and there, and then there's a lot of fighting. But the Taliban, I think they actually exceeded their expectations with this event.
Are they offering some form of amnesty to the government troops, in essence, in these cases? I mean, take us into some of the tactics they're using to establish control. Are they offering through Taliban propaganda, if we show up, meaning the Taliban, and you put down your guns, we'll let bygones be bygones, so to speak? Or are they making examples of people, a combination? What are the tactics they're using to establish control on the ground?
Yeah, primarily what the Taliban have been doing is they've been getting in a lot of these, in some of the cases, they're fighting and gaining control of the districts militarily. In a large number of these cases, the Taliban, they're going into these contested areas where Afghan security forces have been cut off from reinforcement, from resupply. They sometimes can't get wounded troops out unless it's by helicopter. The Taliban are sending tribal leaders who are sympathetic to their cause into these areas, into these outposts, military base, district centers, and saying, look, you could either fight to the death, we are willing to do so, or you can leave with honor. You could leave this outpost. You even see videos when they're retreat, when they're leaving the Afghan soldiers are leaving these bases, they're leaving with a rifle on their shoulder. And that's part of this sort of, you don't want to take a man of the manhood of a Pashtun or of an Afghan away by taking away their weapon, but everything else is left behind. The vehicles, the ammunition, everything else within that base. So it's been very effective for them to send in those interlopers, those mediators in to convince Afghan soldiers who have been largely, in many cases, abandoned by their own government and their own military chain of command to just hold out and fight. And that's why you're seeing large numbers of troops surrendering. I've seen videos of scores and scores of troops surrendering. I've also seen one video, which I can't verify, and it's been on CNN and elsewhere, where there it purports to show Afghan soldiers, the commandos, being executed. This may or may not have happened. If it did happen, then I wouldn't put it past the Taliban. It's the rare case because the Taliban has succeeded in getting so many troops to surrender, so many districts and bases to be turned over to the Taliban by offering this amnesty. But one other quick thing here, the Taliban are taking photographs. They are taking names. If these soldiers do show up in the future, they will pay a price from the Taliban.
And I want to know where we stand, or where the Taliban stands, where we stand from looking across the battlefield at them on shadow governance and the status of, in the areas that they control, are they already starting to provide government functions in essence? Are they now law, you know, the providers of law and justice and taxes and collecting them? And all, is that happening yet, or is that still to be established?
Yes, that is happening. So when this offensive kicked off, the Taliban deputy emir, his name is Sarojuddin Haqqani, he's the head of the Haqqani Network, who, by the way, the United Nations also identified as a leader within al-Qaeda. He issued a lengthy statement that was to all of the Taliban. And his message was, when we take these areas, we must be prepared to govern them. We must govern justly. We mustn't abuse the people. We must dispense justice, et cetera, et cetera. The Taliban have had a robust governance project. It's nothing like we would expect here from the U.S. government, from USAID, or anything like that. But one of the key things that they have been very effective at doing is dispensing justice. It's something it's a country 40 years at war, and there's numerous land disputes in every place because people leaving their homes, other people living in them. The Taliban have proven to settle these disputes quickly. Whether they're fair or not, the Afghan people are accepting the results. But the Taliban has also done things like reorganize the schools and things of that nature and try to provide aid. Again, it's rudimentary. But to the Taliban, remember, what it wants is it wants to reestablish its government. It's called the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. And to be a government, it has to govern. The Taliban recognize this. Again, it may not be up to our levels, but the Afghans, they don't need much. And the Taliban wants to provide just enough to make them look legitimate.
Bill, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate the expertise.
Thank you, sir. A pleasure.
While American troops are evacuating Afghanistan, the U.S. military will maintain a small presence in that nation for at least the next few months. After the break, Amber Smith, a retired Army combat helicopter pilot, will join us to explain how U.S. air power might still affect the war in the days and months ahead. Stay with us. While U.S. troops are pulling out of Afghanistan, that doesn't mean American involvement in the country will come to an end entirely. According to Pentagon officials, U.S. military, and particularly the Navy and Air Force, will remain active in the war at least into September. This leaves open the option of airstrikes against the Taliban in defense of Afghan national forces and local allies. Without boots on the ground, what effect, if any, can American air power have in Afghanistan? Amber Smith is a former Deputy Assistant to the Secretary of Defense for Outreach and a former U.S. Army helicopter combat pilot and air mission commander. She joins me now. Amber, good to see you.
Great to see you, Buck.
So what kind of assets would we be able to deploy from the air specifically to try to help the Afghan National Security Forces, military, police, and all the rest in their fight against the Taliban?
So if we don't have ground elements in the country, it's going to have to be assets from the Air Force or from the Navy who have those longer range fuel capabilities. There's not going to be any sort of U.S. helicopter capabilities without us having a presence in those bases like we've seen the U.S. withdraw from in recent weeks. I will say that this poses a significant risk when you are sending American pilots over hostile territory to work with people like the Afghan National Army and the security forces there, because there is no sort of recovery protocols with U.S. personnel in case there's any sort of a maintenance issue or crash, something like that.
I mean, how effective can such airstrikes from the Air Force and Navy be in the combat environment that you know from flying many missions there in Afghanistan, without U.S. Air combat controllers and forces on the ground to help direct them?
Yeah, so without air traffic or JTACs, the people on the ground who are usually providing visuals and talking on the radios to those pilots in the air, it's going to be very risky and often dangerous. There's lots of higher risks of fratricide, friendly on friendly sort of misidentification, not having positive ID with some of those Afghan forces that we are working with. And so it's really, I want to say, it may help them in the short term. In the long term, it's not going to be that much of a efficient use of funds, you could say. It's going to be very challenging. You're going to have a language barrier, which I've worked with when I was over there, and it is very, very challenging. I have personal experience flying into essentially a firefight on the ground. I'm in a helicopter, and we do not have U.S. forces there. This was back in 2008. Imagine what it looks like today. And we didn't have comms with any U.S. forces on the ground. So we had to make all sorts of decisions without the information that we needed to make what we were trying to do successful. So it's just a lot going on, a lot of moving pieces, and it puts those pilots in a tough situation.
I mean, one area of the U.S. mission in Afghanistan that was ongoing for the entirety of our time there was trying to mentor, train up Afghan military forces, notably ground forces, but also, Amber, to what degree were we able to, and have we been able to, get the Afghan security forces to have rotary and fixed wing aircraft to deploy on their own? I mean, are they in a position to bring some of their own air capabilities in a meaningful way to this fight against the Taliban?
So there have been multiple programs in terms of building up their flight programs. They still have a Black Hawk company. But I will tell you, the problem isn't training pilots. It is ongoing maintenance. And so when you have these aircraft that the United States have provided, these multi-million dollar machines, you have to maintain them in order to safely fly them. And that is where some of the problems come in. We can train their pilots to fly them, but once they go out of currency and they need all of that maintenance work, that's where the problems start happening. And then that's why you see, broken aircraft sitting on a runway that they've parted out for other aircraft, and the fleet just gets smaller and smaller until they don't have anything left.
So right now, would you assess that it's unlikely that the Afghan air wing, such as it is, and I mean for the, obviously for the forces of the government of Afghanistan, not able to bring a substantial piece to the fight? Is this really just going to be a ground war that we're seeing play out against the Taliban?
They may have aviation assets for a short period of time, but long term, this is going to not be any sort of an air war. They may attempt to lean on the U.S. government and the U.S. military, like I said, for that aerial support, but it's going to look more like it's not going to be close air support. It's not going to be helicopters and gunships. If anything, it's going to be, F-18s, F-22s, bomber type aircraft, which they may not use because of precision and all sorts of rules of engagement that go into those types of decision making. And that's what I was emphasizing earlier, is that it just gets a little bit messy when you don't have those people on the ground who are helping target for the munitions that are falling.
What about drones and drone programs, either in assistance to the Afghan National Security Forces or that they're operating themselves? Is that something, is that a part of a program that would be able to at least give them surveillance assistance?
Yeah, so with UAVs and drones, the same issues come up with maintenance. And so when they have the capabilities to fly them, they have to have some sort of a maintenance program that is able to sustain what they need to do to keep them flying. So they may be able to use U.S. assets for a period of time, but any assets that they have as well, they have to maintain that program. And that's where we keep seeing, you know, year after year, we have provided these programs to the Afghan military, and they just continue to fail.
Amber, given the rapid deterioration we're already seeing in Afghanistan, how concerned are you that there will be a push to put additional assets, air assets, special operations, et cetera, back in country in the next few months just to try to slow down the toppling dominoes?
Yeah, that's definitely a concern of mine. That seems like the yo-yo effect that we have seen in the Middle East the last couple of decades, is that as soon as there is a rise in whatever enemy we were currently fighting, the quick answer is to, you know, send in special operations troops. That's not the answer here. We have known what Afghanistan is going to look like for some time, within months to a year of us leaving. Those of us that, you know, the Afghan government will try for a period of time, but the reality is that the Taliban is going to take back over in terms of the government in that country. And so that's what the reality looks like. If we want to continue this special operations game where we send them in every so often to push back the Taliban, that's delaying the inevitable. The future of Afghanistan looks as I exactly just described it. It doesn't matter if it's in 2 months or if we continue to play this yo-yo game for the next decade. Just matters on how many U.S. forces and how many billions of dollars we spend in the meantime.
Amber, thank you so much for your expertise and for your service. It's good to see you.
Thanks, Buck. Great to see you.
We'll be back with more of this special edition of Hold the Line. While we rightfully honor the men and women of the U.S. Armed Forces who served in Afghanistan, it's also important to remember that American servicemen weren't the only ones putting their lives on the line for our side during the war. The U.S. effort was also supported by tens of thousands of Afghan nationals serving in support roles, most notably as interpreters. As a condition of their employment, many were promised special immigrant visas, or SIVs, which would allow them to come to America when their service was completed. Unfortunately, many interpreters remain in Afghanistan awaiting their visas while their lives are imperiled by the steady advance of the Taliban. So what's being done to honor America's commitment, our promise to these often unsung heroes? Joining me now is Amadullah Siddiqui, a former Afghan interpreter and SIV ambassador for the No One Left Behind organization. Amadullah, thank you for being with us. As U.S. troops leave the country, what are you hearing about the situation of fellow interpreters who are still in Afghanistan?
First of all, good afternoon. Thanks for having me. We receive emails on a daily basis, emails, messages through our social media platform, even though most of them cannot or do not have access to the internet, but they find ways to connect with us and tell us all their stories, you know, the threats they have been through and the problems they are being faced on a daily basis. You know that 18,000+ interpreters are still left behind, and they're waiting for the United States to keep their promise and bring them back home. A lot of them, you know, first of all, you know, we respect the vetting process, but it takes too long.
What is the biggest hurdle? And it would seem like this is rather straightforward, right? They've worked with the U.S. military. They were promised the United States should keep its promises. Is this just bureaucratic slowness?
It is the slowness. Yes, we respect, you know, the vetting process of the SIVs in the United States. At the same time, you know, 3.5 years is too much for only a paperwork. It normally takes three to six to nine months, you know, to get all the paperwork done and get a person visas. But 3.5 years is too much. We don't understand why it takes too long. And at the same time, as I said, you know, we respect the vetting process, but it shouldn't take that long.
And what kind of threat are interpreters who stay behind under from the Taliban? Has the Taliban already made it clear? Or are they putting out pronouncements, leaflets that are essentially threats against any interpreters that remain behind? I mean, give people an understanding of how dire the situation is for those who help the U.S. and are now stuck in Afghanistan.
Actually, we do not trust Taliban. They have killed many of our lives back in 2 decades. You know that recently, and the Taliban are capturing the biggest cities in Afghanistan, and they are persecuting our allies, those who worked, who risked their lives for the United Forces and the lives of their families. So they're torturing them, you know, for assisting the United States Army.
And is there any other option? I mean, assuming that some of these delays right now seem like they're going to continue in getting interpreters out of Afghanistan, are there any other countries that are trying to step in here, other NATO allies, for example, that may try to get them out? Is there, you know, if the U.S. is moving too slowly, is the U.K. or Germany an option? How does that work?
So actually, we promised them, and we should keep our promise to bring our last home. And last week, the president, you know, announced and said that 2,500 people, interpreters, will directly, you know, evacuate it and bring them to D.C. And after that, you know, the question is, what will happen to the 16,000+ people, including their families? And the third country is, you know, we want them to bring them to one of the U.S. territory, the U.S. soil. If not, then there should be a country where these interpreters and these folks should feel safe in order to get out of that, you know, a dangerous place.
So, I mean, you're an ambassador for No One Left Behind, a nonprofit trying to help interpreters. Tell us a little bit about what you've been doing, what the organization does, and perhaps what needs to happen to get the kind of attention necessary at policy level, at the deciding level of the government, in order to get interpreters out of Afghanistan and fulfill this obligation, this promise, as you rightly point out, that we, the American people, made to Afghans who helped.
Well, the No One Left Behind's current mission is to facilitate the SIV resettlement in the United States. And we keep our nation's promise by, you know, trying to fix the State Department's 14-step SIV process. With its 3.5 years wait time, which is too much, and by providing emergency financial aid and youth, you know, vehicles to our newly arrived SIVs to the United States. And to your question that what we as a people can do, so what I would suggest is we all need to get out of our comfort zone and email, text, or call our congressmen and women, and this, obviously the senators, you know, to act immediately in order to keep our promise.
I have to ask, given what you're seeing right now, the news stories about Taliban advances and something we're talking about extensively on this show, how worried are you that there could be an all-out collapse? Are you hopeful that the Afghan national government's forces will be able to stop and then turn around this Taliban momentum?
So actually, yes, we believe in the stability of the Afghan national forces. We believe in their strength. But at the same time, you know, the Taliban, they're moving forward in capturing all the cities and killing our allies. Yes.
So very concerning. All right. Well, anything that we can do to help, anything we can do to help get interpreters out, please let us know. Is there a website people can go for No One Left Behind?
Yes. So you can go to noonelef.org.
Noonelef.org.
So there, you know, you can find too many stories out there.
Yeah. People should go check it out. Thank you so much for what you're doing, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right, that's all the time we have for this special edition of Hold the Line. But before we go, I just want to say thank you for watching The First TV and supporting this network, the only one dedicated to protecting free speech. Reminder, you can watch my show live or on demand at any time with The First TV app. The best part, The First TV app is 100% free. Just search The First TV in the App Store on your phone, tablet, or smart TV and download it today. Special thanks to all my guests for sharing their expertise and experience. The No Spin News with Bill O'Reilly is up next. Shields high.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.